The Zen Manifesto, Freedom from Oneself, Number 1. An Osho talk given spontaneously at an outdoor meeting to an international audience of thousands of people.
When Tenjiku was asked about the incident of Tanka burning the statue, he replied, "When it is cold, we gather around the hearth by the fire." Was he wrong or not? Persisted the monk. "When it is hot, we sit in a bamboo forest in the valley," said Tenjiku. The day after the burning of the statue, Tanka Tenen went to see Nanyo, who had once been a disciple of Ino and was the emperor's Zen master. When Tanka unrolled his Zazen rug, Nanyo said, "There's no need." Tanka took a few steps backward. Nanyo said, "That's right." At this, Tanka took a few steps forward. Nanyo said, "That's not right." Tanka walked around Nanyo one time and left. Nanyo commented, "The old golden days are far away, and people are now so lazy. 30 years from now, it will be difficult to get hold of this fellow."
Friends, a new series of talks begins today. The Zen Manifesto, Freedom from Oneself. It is time, right time, for a Zen Manifesto. The Western intelligentsia has become acquainted with Zen, has also fallen in love with Zen, but they are still trying to approach Zen from the mind. They have not yet come to the understanding that Zen has nothing to do with mind. Its tremendous job is to get you out of the prison of mind, It is not an intellectual philosophy. It is not a philosophy at all. Neither it is a religion, because it has no fictions and no lies, no consolations. It is a lion's roar. And the greatest thing that Zen has brought into the world is freedom from oneself. All the religions have been talking about dropping your ego. But it is a very weird phenomenon that they want to drop you, your ego. And the ego is just a shadow of God. God is the ego of the universe, and the ego is your personality. Just as God is the very center of existence according to religions, your ego is the center of your mind, of your personality. They all have been talking about dropping the ego, but it cannot be dropped unless God is dropped. You cannot drop a shadow or a reflection unless the source of its manifestation is destroyed. So religions have been talking continuously for centuries that you should get rid of the ego, but for wrong reasons. They were asking you to drop your ego so you can surrender to God, so you can surrender to the priests, so you can surrender to any kind of nonsense, any kind of theology, superstitions, belief systems. But you cannot drop the ego if it is a reflection of God. God is a lie there in the universe, and ego is a lie within your mind. Your mind is simply reflecting a bigger lie according to its size. So religions put humanity in a great dilemma. They went on praising God and they went on condemning the ego. So people were in a very split state, in a schizophrenic space. They tried hard to drop the ego, but the harder they tried, the harder it became to drop it. Because who was going to drop it? The ego was trying to drop itself. That's an impossibility. So even in the humblest so-called religious people, the ego becomes very subtle, but it is not dropped. You can see in the eyes of your saints . One of my sannyasins went to see Yuji Krishnamurti, and because he argued with him, he immediately became angry . And these people, like Yuji Krishnamurti, are talking to people to drop anger, to drop greed, to drop ego. But if you provoke them, just skin deep is their whole religion. Inside is hiding a very pious ego. And when ego becomes pious, it becomes piousness. It is more dangerous because you become absolutely unaware of it. It goes so deep down in the unconscious. U.G. Krishnamurti has lived with J. Krishnamurti for 12 years and he never mentions his name. And if somebody brings J. Krishnamurti's name, he immediately condemns J. Krishnamurti. And whatever he is saying is just an imitation of J. Krishnamurti, paraphrasing. And the reason why he cannot accept the fact that he has been with J. Krishnamurti for 12 years is very simple. The moment he accepts that he has been with J. Krishnamurti for 12 years, then you can compare his statements with J. Krishnamurti and you will find they are simply paraphrasing. He is repeating, imitating, he knows nothing. These people have been around the world all the time. They have tried whatever the religions have been telling to them, but their effort cannot remove the shadow. If there is a shadow of the bamboos, you cannot remove the bamboo shadows unless you remove the bamboos. You cannot directly remove the shadows. They are a byproduct. If the bamboos remain there, the shadows are going to remain there. They can become very subtle. I have heard a story about a fox coming out of the cave where he used to live early in the morning. As the sun was riding behind her, rising, her shadow was very long. She said, "My God, I am this big." I will need almost a camel for my breakfast. And she started searching for a camel for his breakfast. But the fox could not manage to find a camel. It was just middle of the day and the sun was on the head of the fox. The fox was feeling very hungry. He had another look at the shadow and the shadow has disappeared. It has not disappeared. It has come just below the fox. As long as the fox is there, the shadow is going to be there, but now it is absolutely invisible. To the fox, everybody else can see it, But the fox cannot see it. It has come just underneath. That's what happens to so-called religious people. They force their shadows, their egos, their anger, their greed, their ambitions in the unconscious. But in the unconscious, they are there and far more dangerous because you are not aware of them. You think they have disappeared. When Maya Sannyasin started with Yuji Krishnamurti arguing, before argument he was just a great saint, so silent, so peaceful. And as the argument began, and he was afraid to be caught, he could not answer the questions. Anger suddenly arose. He may not have been aware of that anger, but Maya Sannyasin helped him. He wanted to get rid of the Sannyasin, and it is Yuji Krishnamurti, who is not an authentic or sincere man. But you can fall into the trap because he is repeating beautiful phrases. His memory is good and his intellect is good. And this is the shadow. Even the original man, Jai Krishnamurti, used to become very angry just seeing Maya Sannyasins. I had told Maya Sannyasins, everywhere, wherever Jai Krishnamurti speaks, you just sit in the front line. And at that time, sannyasins were wearing red clothes, so they were absolutely recognizable. They were having a mala with my photo in the locket. And the moment Jai Krishnamurti will see my sannyasins all around, he will forget on what subject he was going to speak. He will start condemning me, condemning sannyas. And this man was talking his whole life about awareness. And he has forgotten the subject completely. And it was not once, because Maya Sannyasins were everywhere, wherever he was going to speak, in London, in San Francisco, in Bombay, in New Delhi, in Madras, wherever he was going to speak, Maya Sannyasins were there, just in the front rows. And he was so much allergic. The moment he will see the Sannyasins, he will lose all control. At some times he even started beating his head, that why you come here? I am against sannyas. And I had told my people, laugh joyously. Make him as angry as possible. That will bring the original man, which is hiding behind. And he could not even understand that why it is happening everywhere. And he is being distracted. He will start condemning me, condemning sannyas, and will become almost neurotic. And seeing my sannyasins laughing, was almost putting more fire, and he will become more and more angry. He could not understand why these people don't feel offended. On the contrary, they are laughing. His whole time will be taken by the sannyasins. It is very easy to talk about beautiful things, intellectual grass, Krishnamurti has been forced by the theologists of a particular brand, the Theosophical Society. It was a worldwide organization in the beginning of this century. And it was preparing J. Krishnamurti to be a world teacher. Nobody can prepare anybody to be a world teacher. Anything that has been prepared is going to be false. And they almost tortured him in the name of discipline. And they got hold of him at the age of 9. And from that moment, he was not allowed to move into the world, he was not allowed to go into the society. He was continuously hammered with his scriptures. 3 o'clock early in the morning, he has to get up, take a cold bath, and be ready for the Theosophist leaders of the movement who will recite Sanskrit scriptures, Tibetan scriptures, Zen scriptures. And he was almost asleep, a 9-year-old child. And this went on up to his 25 years. They managed to create a certain personality. You can only create a personality. And they had the hope that they have succeeded in creating a world teacher. Now he was writing beautiful poems, beautiful articles, which were published by a section of Theosophical Society which has been created especially for J. Krishnamurti. The organization was called the Star of the East. And they used to publish magazines, periodicals, literature, all about Krishnamurti, creating the atmosphere around the world to receive him as a world teacher. But it was all forced from outside. J. Krishnamurti has no realization, but he was intelligent enough to grasp slowly all the scriptures. but he was honest also. Yuji Krishnamurti is not even honest. Finally, when they thought that he is ready, they called a world conference in Holland, which used to be their great world centers. 6,000 leaders of theosophical movement from all the countries gathered to receive Jai Krishnamurti and declare that he is the world teacher. He came on the stage, and it is a very historical moment of honesty that he said, "I am not a world teacher." It was a shock. To the whole theosophical movement, it shattered the whole movement. But he has become completely accustomed about the whole great literature of mysticism. He dissolved the organization Star of the East, which was specially created for him, and he left the Theosophical Society, and he lived his whole life in a reaction. He was a giant intelligence. The reaction was against all those people who had forced him to do things which were not coming naturally to him. He was not allowed to be natural at all. He was not allowed to meet any girl. He was not allowed to mix with ordinary people. He was not allowed to enter into any ordinary school or college, private tutors, so that he can be proved to the world a superior being. As if he is coming directly as a messiah from God. And obviously, if he was dishonest, he could have told to the world that, "I am a world teacher." He was ready for it. Intellectually, his memory was completely programmed. But because everything was imposed, it also created deep down in him a rebellion. He knows nothing what he is talking about, what he is writing, he knows nothing. His one of the best books is At the Feet of the Master. That was published when he was almost 13 or 14 years old. Just to prove that even at the age of 14, he can produce such a great book. And it was not written by him. It was written by a man called Leadbeater. He was one of his tutors and very profound scholar about the Eastern religions. I have looked into all the theosophical literature of that time to find out the style, to whose style that book fits. Leadbeater has already written many books. So showing great intelligence and scholarship. The book that was published in Jai Krishnamurti's name was written by him and perhaps polished by others. Jai Krishnamurti does not even remember that when he has written that book, when he left the Theosophical movement, he was asked, what about the book At the Feet of the Master, which has become a worldwide bestseller? It is a beautiful book. But he said, I don't know. I don't remember to have written it. He was honest. But because all these things were imposed on him, there was a constant reaction, rebellion, and he lived in that reaction his whole life. Theosophical movement destroyed the man. He may have become a Gautam Buddha. He has every possibility. But because of this reaction, he fought his whole life those dead tutors, those dead theosophical leaders, Annie Besant, Leadbeater and others. He was fighting with those shadows his whole life against masters, against mystics, against scriptures, but it was not coming as a revelation. It was coming as a reaction. His whole life was wasted by the Theosophical movement. If they have allowed him to grow naturally, there was possibility. The man had the potential of being a Gautam Buddha, but they destroyed him. And he could not get rid of those shadows. He lived in his early childhood, became so ingrained that he was fighting against them. He lived in a negativity, and one cannot live in a negativity and be nourished and blossom in a lotus flower. So even Jai Krishnamurti was not enlightened. And U.G. Krishnamurti is a shadow of an unenlightened, intelligent giant. And U.G. Krishnamurti is not even an intellectual giant. But he goes on preaching the same words, the same language, but tries to hide the fact just the other day I saw in a newspaper an article about him. He was asked by interviewer, when and where you became enlightened? And his answer is, I don't know when and where. But enlightenment does not happen in time or in space. When and where are time and space? It happens when you are nowhere, no one. It happens when there is eternity, no time. So his answer may impress many people. People are very gullible. I am taking his instance for a particular reason, because the whole Western intelligentsia has become immensely interested in Zen, but their interest remains intellectual. And they have written great books, and we will be discussing in this manifesto almost everyone who has written books on Zen. And my effort is to make you cleanly clear that all these intellectuals may have written very beautiful books. I appreciate their scholarship, I appreciate their articulateness to express, but they are not men of Zen. Nothing to be said about masters of Zen. Hence, this manifesto is absolutely needed to make the whole world clear that Zen is not a mind affair. It is a no-mind space. I told you, all the religions are saying, drop the ego. Zen goes beyond the ego and beyond the self. Except Zen, no religion has come to the point going beyond the self, beyond the Atma, beyond your spirit, beyond your individuality. It is absolutely a single man's contribution to human consciousness. Gautama the Buddha. And Zen is the ultimate flowering, slowly, slowly improving the image of Gautama the Buddha. Each master has contributed something, a new dimension to it. Gautama Buddha is the only person in the whole history of mankind who said, just dropping the ego will not help. It can be easily dropped if you drop the God. He dropped God. Ego disappeared. The moon disappeared, the reflection disappeared. You went away from the mirror was empty. Your reflection in the mirror disappeared. You were fighting with the reflection. I have heard about an ugly woman who was so neurotic about mirrors, because only mirrors make her aware that she is ugly. Otherwise, she was beautiful as far as she was concerned, without mirrors. Wherever she will see a mirror, even in somebody else's house, she will immediately break it. And the reason was that mirrors make her look ugly. Those poor mirrors has nothing to do with her ugliness. She was ugly, but she was forcing the responsibility on the mirrors, fighting with the mirrors, and that is the essence of all your religions, fighting with the mirrors, with the shadows, trying to drop the ego without dropping the God. And the ego is just a reflection of a lie in your small pond of the mind. Gautama Buddha dropped the idea of God and was amazed that as God disappears, the ego disappears. It was just a reflection of God. Hence my effort to remove God. Because without removing God, you cannot remove the ego. It is the shadow in a small pond of your mind, of the ultimate life. And then he came to understand, as ego disappeared with the God, that even self has to disappear. There are religions who have God, ego, and the self. Judaism, Christianity, Mohammedanism, Hinduism. And there are religions which don't have God, Taoism, Buddhism, Jainism. But they have the self, because they don't have God, the ego disappears on its own. Now, their whole effort is how to make their self pure, pious. Now, a different kind of effort starts. Buddha is the only man who said, if there is no God and there is no ego, the self is also arbitrary, artificial. As you go deeper in your interiority, you suddenly find disappearing into the oceanic consciousness. There is no self as such. You are no more, only existence is. Hence, I call Zen essentially freedom from oneself. You have heard about other freedoms, but freedom from oneself is the ultimate freedom. Not to be, and allow the existence to express itself in all its spontaneity and grandeur. But it is existence, not you, not me. It is life itself dancing, not you, not me. That is the Zen manifesto. Freedom from oneself. And only Zen has refined in these 25 centuries methods, devices, how to make you aware that you are not, that you are only arbitrary, just an idea. As you go beyond the mind, even the idea of I am disappears. When the I also disappears, and you start feeling a deep involvement in existence, no boundaries, then only Zen has blossomed in you. In fact, that is the state, the space of the awakened consciousness. But it has no I at the center, no Atman, no Self. To make it clear to you, Socrates says, know thyself. Gautama Buddha says, know. Just know, and you will not find thyself. Enter deeper into your awareness, and the deeper you go, yourself starts melting. Perhaps that is the reason why all the religions except Zen have not tried meditation. Because meditation will destroy God, will destroy ego, will destroy self. It will leave you into absolute nothingness. And it is just the mind which makes you afraid about nothingness. I receive questions almost every day that why we are afraid of nothingness. You are afraid because you don't know nothingness. And you are afraid only because you figure out intellectually that what is the point? If in meditation you have to disappear, then it is better to remain in the mind, at least you are. Maybe illusory, maybe just an idea, but at least you are. What is the point of making all this effortless effort and just disappear into nothingness? The mind simply makes you beware not to go beyond the boundaries of the mind, because beyond the boundaries of the mind you will be no more. That will be ultimate death. A Gautam Buddha dies ultimately. You die only temporarily. Just maybe few minutes, few seconds, and you enter into another womb. Some idiots are always making love around the world, 24 hours. And you don't have to travel far away, just in the neighborhood. Around the clock, millions of couples are making love. So whichever is the closest couple, here you die and there you are born. The gap is very small. But an enlightened man, a man who has come to know his nothingness, his no-selfness, his anatta, simply disappears into the cosmos. Mind is afraid. And obviously it seems logical. What is the point? Why one should do such a thing in which he disappears? Gautam Buddha was asked again and again that you are a strange fellow. We had come here to realize ourselves. And your meditation is to unrealize ourselves. Socrates was just a great genius, but confined to the mind. Know thyself. There is no self to be known. That is the Zen manifesto to the world. There is nothing to know. You have just to be one with the whole. And there is no need to be afraid. Just think for a moment. When you were not born, was there any anxiety, any worry, any angst? You were not there. there was no problem. You are the problem, the beginning of the problem. And then as you grow, more and more problems. But before your birth, was there any problem? Zen masters continuously ask the newcomers, where you have been before your father was born? Absurd question, but of immense significance. They are asking you that if you were not, there was no problem. So what is the worry? If your death becomes ultimate death and all boundaries disappear, you will not be there, but the existence will be there. And the dance will be there, dancer will not be there. The song will be there, but the singer will not be there. This is possible only to experience by falling deeper beyond the mind to the very depth of your being, from where your life is flowing through to the very source of life. And suddenly you realize the image of yourself was arbitrary. You are imageless. You are infinite. You were living in a cage. The moment you realize your sources are infinite, suddenly the cage disappears and you can open your wings into the blue sky and disappear. This disappearance is anatta. This disappearance is freedom from oneself. But this is possible not through intellect. It is possible only through meditation. Zen is another name for meditation. Hundreds of beautiful books have appeared in the West. Since a very strange man, D.T. Suzuki, introduced Zen to the West. He did a pioneer job, but he was not a Zen master or even a man of Zen. He was a great scholar, and his impact went over all the countries to the intelligentsia. Immediately he had a great appeal. And as the old religions are crumbling, particularly in the West, Christianity is just a name. The empire is crumbling. They are trying to hold it, but it is not possible. It is falling apart. And a vacuum is growing, every day bigger and bigger, like an abysmal depth which creates nausea. Jyapal Sat's book, Nausea, is very significant. Once you see the bottomless pit, this meaningless life, you are utterly arbitrary, unnecessary, accidental. You lose all dignity. And for what you are waiting, there is nothing to wait for. Only death. This creates a great anxiety that we are worthless. Nobody needs us. Existence is careless. At that very moment, D.T. Suzuki appeared on the horizon in the West. He was the first man to talk about Zen in the Western universities, colleges, and he attracted immensely the intelligent people, because they have lost faith in God. They have lost faith in the Holy Bible. They have lost faith in the Pope. Just today, almost a dozen German bishops have come to a declaration together that Pope is going beyond his limits. Now, this is pure rebellion. That his continuous preaching against birth control is bringing humanity to a point where half of the world is going to die out of starvation. Pope should not be listened anymore. These one dozen bishops in Germany have made a committee, and they are collecting more and more bishops to rebel against the Pope, and they are declaring that he is not infallible. The whole history of bishops shows the popes and archbishops that they are fallible. So this whole idea of Pope being the infallible was making him an absolute dictator. Now it is intolerable. In the beginning of this century was the starting of a boiling up energy against all old religions, particularly in the rich countries of the West. Poor countries don't have time. They don't have even food enough, no nourishment. Their whole time is involved into food, into clothing, into getting a shelter. They can't discuss great problems of life. They can't even conceive. The question is food, not God. That's why it is so easy to convert poor people into Christianity, just by providing food, just by providing shelter, service. But they are not converted to the Christianity. They are simply not concerned about God. They are not concerned about any system of beliefs. Their basic thing is they are hungry and starving. When you are hungry and starving, you don't think of God. You don't think of hell and heaven. You think the first thing is where to get some bread and butter. And if anybody gives you bread and butter with the condition that you have to be a Catholic, you will agree, rather than dying out of starvation. So poor countries are becoming more and more Catholic, more and more Christian. But in the West itself, Christianity is losing its hold. Not more than 25% people attend the churches. 75% people are completely disappointed, and those 25% are mostly women. And for a particular reason, that is the only place where you can gossip and meet all other women and see who has got better clothes, better fur coats, better jewelry, a better car. The church is the only club where the women are accepted. All other clubs are boys' clubs, where old boys talk about women but don't allow women in. Even in parties, as the dinner is complete, the women retire to a separate room and leave the boys alone, because they will be drinking and shouting and fighting and talking all kinds of nonsense which they cannot in front of women. They feel a little embarrassed. So women retire. And this is good. Women have their own gossiping. Who is falling in love with whom? Let the boys do their work. The old girls are doing their work. The church is the only place which all the religions have allowed women together. Otherwise, they are boycotted from every other social congregation. They cannot be members of many organizations, many clubs. They are all male-oriented. The woman's area, her territory is the home. She has to be confined in that territory. So the church was the only outlet. They wait for the Sunday. These 25% are women, are few male may be there, who cannot leave their wives alone out of fear, and few male may be there to find out a new girlfriend. But this is nothing to do with religion. D.T. Suzuki appeared in the West with a new approach to existence. And he appealed, because he was a man of great scholarship, profound scholarship. And he brought to the Western mind a totally new concept of religion. But it remained a concept. It remained an argument in the mind, but it never went deeper than that. A parallel exists in China. Before Bodhidharma appeared in China, China was already converted to Buddhism. Bodhidharma went there 1400 years before. But Gautam Buddha's philosophy and religion has reached there 2000 years before. 600 years before Bodhidharma went there. In these 600 years, scholars converted the whole China into Buddhism. And in those days it was very easy to convert the whole country. You simply convert the emperor. And then his whole court gets converted, then his whole army gets converted, then his whole bureaucracy gets converted. And when the emperor and the whole bureaucracy and the army and all the so-called wise people of the emperor's court are converted, masses simply follow. Masses have never decided anything for themselves. They simply look at the people who proclaim themselves great in power, in intelligence, in riches. If these people are converted, the masses simply follow. So in those 600 years, thousands of Buddhist scholars reached to China and they converted the China, the emperors, the governors, but it was not the true message of Gautam Buddha yet. Although China has become Buddhist, but Buddha has not appeared yet. Bodhidharma was sent by his master who was a woman. That scholars have prepared the way, now you go, you are immensely needed there. Bodhidharma was the first Buddha to enter China and brought a totally different vision, not that of the mind, but of no mind. The West is absolutely ready for a Zen manifesto. Intellectually, D.T. Suzuki Alan Watts and many others. We will be discussing each one. They have done. They have prepared the road. Now only a Bodhidharma is needed. Only a Gautam Buddha is needed. Or a Mahakashyapa. Someone whose Zen is not only a philosophy, but an actual experience of no self. Actual experience of entering into nothingness. And once you enter into nothingness, you will be surprised that it is nothing to be afraid of. This is your real home. And now you can celebrate, because there is nothing more than this mystery, that nothingness opens all the doors. As long as you are confined by the self, the very idea of separation with existence keeps you miserable. You have to find ways, and these ways can be found easily only when you have somebody who has already traveled the path, who knows that nothingness is not something empty. By disappearing, you are not really disappearing. You are becoming the whole. From this side it looks like you are disappearing. From that side it looks you are becoming the whole. Just ask a dewdrop. I have told you about Kabir. When he first entered into this nothingness, he immediately wrote a beautiful poetry in which comes the sentence, "The dewdrop has fallen into the ocean." His own sentences are very beautiful. Herat, Herat, He Sakhi, Raya Kabir Hirai. O my friend, my beloved, I had gone to search to seek myself. But something strange has happened. Rather than finding myself, I have disappeared just like a dewdrop disappearing in the ocean. Bund samani samund mein sokat heri jai. The dewdrop has disappeared in the ocean. Now how you can find the dewdrop again? That was his first experience. As he became more and more aware of the ocean and forgot all about the dewdrop, before dying he called his son Kamal, and he was certainly a man rightly named by Kabir. Kamal means a miracle. And the son of Kabir was certainly a miracle. He called Kamal and said to him that, "I am going to leave my body soon. Before I leave, you have to correct one of my poems. Just a little change. I have written Bund Samani Samund Mein. The dewdrop has entered into the ocean. You have to change it. Just reverse it. Samund samana bund mein. The ocean has disappeared into the dewdrop. Because now I know from the other side. My first experience was from this shore. Now I am talking from the further shore beyond. Now I know the dewdrop has not fallen into the ocean. It is the ocean that has fallen into the dewdrop." Kamal said to him, "I have always suspected that line. I can show you my copy." And he showed, he has crossed that line. Kabir said, "You are really a Kamal. You are a miracle. You came to know it before me." The line was crossed. Kamal said, "I was suspicious from the very beginning that this is a statement of a beginner. The first statement when he comes to see the nothingness, but when he becomes nothingness, this statement will be absolutely wrong. So now you have come to your senses. Just before dying, I can rejoice that you are no more just a beginner. You have become part of the whole." He wrote the new line. "The ocean has fallen into the dewdrop. I said to you that Kabir has named his only son Kamal, a miracle, because the young man was certainly not an ordinary man. At a point, even Kabir was angry with him. Because he used to raise questions which even Kabir could not answer. And this was happening always when thousands of Kabir's followers will be there, his own son will stand up. And make him feel very embarrassed because he was not able to answer the question. In one day he was very angry. That must have happened before his enlightenment. And he said to Kamal, "Bura bans Kabir ka, my family ends with you, Kamal." He is meaning the same by my family as Zen people call their heritage, their family, their masters. They are not talking about their parents. Kabir said, "My family ends with me. I cannot trust you." Kamal said, "If you cannot trust me, you cannot trust yourself. But because you have disowned me by saying this statement, I will not be staying in your cottage. I am going to make a small hut just in front of you." So when gullible people come to you, when they are going back home, I will deprogram them. And he remained just in front of Kabir's house, and because everybody knew he is Kabir's son, so before leaving Kabir, they will go to pay tribute to his son also. Even the emperor of Varanasi was a devotee of Kabir. Kabir was a poor man, a weaver. And the emperor of Varanasi asked one day when he could not see Kamal for a few days, he was coming almost every day to listen to Kabir, and he was watching that Kamal is missing. He asked Kabir, "Where is Kamal?" Kabir said, "It is a sad story. I was just angry and I told that my family ends with me." And he immediately left, saying that if your family ends with you, I no more belong to your family. He remains outside, just in front, disturbing my disciples. He is a pain in the neck. Now he is gone out, so I cannot even say anything. But just he sits there, the emperor of Kasi said, Kasi is the older name of Varanasi. That I would go and see him. But what is your problem with him? Kabir said, thousands of problems. People come with money, diamonds, emeralds, and all kinds of valuable things, and I don't need them. So I refuse them. And he is just sitting by my side, tells those people, "Okay, if he is refusing, bring them to me." Anyway, it doesn't look good that you have come to offer and you are going rejected. Offer to me. So I reject and he goes on collecting. And I have told him that this is not right. But he said, you think about yourself. I know on my own accord what is right and what is wrong. Don't tell me. I am not your disciple. I am your son. So the emperor said, don't be worried. I will go and see and check. So he brought with him a very big diamond and asked Kamal that I had brought this most valuable diamond in the country as an offering to you. He said, you can put it into the bamboos of my roof of the hut. If somebody does not take it away, it will remain there. Once in a while I can see that I have got the greatest valuable stone in my hut. I don't have much decoration here. The emperor thought that Kabir seems to be right. He is very clever and cunning. He is not taking it, but he is telling me, just put there if somebody does not take it away. I will enjoy it, seeing it. And as I will go out, he will take it. That is certain. So the emperor remained for 1 week, did not come. After 1 week he came and he asked Kamal, where is that diamond? Kamal said, if somebody has taken, then it will not be in the roof. Otherwise, it is bound to be in the roof. You had put it yourself, so you can find it easily. And I had not any opportunity to look at it. I am looking inwards and your diamond is outside. The emperor said, great, and he looked and found the diamond exactly where he has put in the hut. He told Kabir that you are in a misunderstanding. Your son is really a miracle. I was thinking that he is cheating me, deceiving me. But he has not even looked at the diamond, not to say anything of touching it. He said to me, if anybody has taken, then I don't know, because I am looking inwards. So anybody can take it. There is no guard on the hut, there is no door. And sometimes I have to go to the Ganges to take a bath, and anybody can take it. So if it remains, you will find it. And I have found it, it was there. He has not even looked at it. So your whole idea is wrong. Your idea that he is interested in wealth is absolutely wrong. Finally, Kabir has to go to the hut and ask Kamal, forgive me, come back. I was wrong. You were just trying to test me that whether I get angry or not. And I certainly got angry. I thought it was your greed. Kamal said, I am your blood, your bones, your very marrow. How could you ever think that I should be greedy? And you became angry. and you expose yourself that all your teaching of not to be angry, not to be greedy, was just superficial. It is not your concern. If I am taking things, why you are interested? There must be some greed in you. Just as anger came up, your greed may come up any moment. If there was no greed in you, you would have simply witnessed that Kamal is taking things, that's all. It is Kamal's business to take care of his own being. It is not your business. I am not your disciple. I am a master on my own authority. And Kabir looked into himself and agreed to Kamal that perhaps you are right. My being interested and being angry that you are gathering money shows my greed, not your greed. Shows my anger, not your anger. And you left so joyously, touching my feet, that if you say your family ends with yourself, then a new family starts with me, just in front of you. So Kamal was persuaded back into the family, and he was the successor of Kabir. Far more greater a man. Far more aware, alert, far more conscious. But strangely, Kabir is remembered. He has an organized religion behind him, Kabir Panth, the path of Kabir. Kamal has nothing. He never created any following, although hundreds of people listened to him, but he remained only a friend. He helped them, shared his light with them, but never was giving any discipline, any commandments, any principles to be followed. Once you know meditation, you don't have to follow anybody. You have your own eyes open and you have your light just ahead of you, showing the path. And choicelessly, all that is right and all that is good happens. It is not that you are doing it, you cannot do otherwise. Six hundred years in China, Buddhism was only an intellectual exercise, good gymnastics. But as Bodhidharma entered, he changed the whole idea about Zen. People were talking about Zen as if it is another philosophy. It is not. As if it is another religion. It is not. It is a rebellion against mind, and all your religions and philosophies are part of the mind. And this is the only rebellion against mind, against self. The only rebellion of withdrawing all the limits that imprison you. and taking a quantum leap into nothingness. But this nothingness is very alive. It is life. It is existence. It is not a hypothesis. And when you take the jump, the first experience is you are disappearing. The last experience is you have become the whole. Few questions. The first question, why so many Western intellectuals being drawn to an examination of Zen? Because they are feeling a great vacuum. And they want to fill the vacuum. You cannot live with a vacuum. The vacuum is empty. And out of emptiness, life becomes sad, serious. And all the religions have been filling your vacuum with lies. Now those lies are exposed. Science has done much in exposing those lies. And great meditators, mystics have done tremendous work around the world in exposing all the lies of religions. The modern contemporary man stands in a strange position. The old has fallen. Was a deception. And the new has not arrived. So there is a gap, an interval. And the Western intelligentsia is trying to find something which will not be again a lie, which will not only give you consolation, which will transform you, which will be a deep revolution in your very being. And Zen certainly is the right approach towards existence, the ultimate truth. Without believing into anything, without being a follower or a believer, you simply enter into your own interiority. And you are entering into the immense nothingness of the whole. But it is the same nothingness from where you had come and to where you are going again. When the source and the goal become one, you will have a great celebration. In that celebration you will not be, but the whole existence will be participating. The trees will be showering flowers, and the birds will be singing songs, and the oceans and the rivers, all will be rejoicing. The whole existence becomes your home. The moment your heart melts into the universal heart, that is where Zen is happening. In that melting into the universe, you are back to the original source. Fresh, eternal, timeless, spacious, The only thing needed is freedom from the self. That is the very essence of Zen. You have heard about many freedoms, political freedom, psychological freedom, economic freedom, and there are many kinds of freedom. But the ultimate freedom is Zen. Freedom from yourself. And that is not to be accepted as a belief. That has to be experienced. Only then you know. It is a taste. Anybody can describe that sugar is sweet, but if you have not tasted the sugar, the word sweet you hear, but you don't understand what is sweet. The only way is that somebody forces some sweet into your mouth. The master's function in Zen is to force nothingness into your experience, or in other words, to bring you to your own nothingness. The master decides and devices methods. When they become old and routine, he drops them, finds new methods, new ways. But for these 25 centuries, since Gautama Buddha gave, without a single word, a lotus flower to Mahakashyapa and told his congregation that what I could say, I have told you. What I cannot say, although I want, but simply it is not possible, I am transferring it to Mahakashyapa. That lotus flower was just a symbol. That unless you open up like a lotus flower in the early morning sun, when the dew drops are shining like pearls on the lotus leaves, it is a silent transmission of the lamp. Nothing is said. Mahakashyapa came for the first time close to Buddha, took the lotus flower, touched his feet, went back and sat silently under his tree. Mahakashyapa is the first patriarch of Zen. So lineage of Zen, the family of Zen, is a branch, a very silent branch, they love Gautama Buddha because it was really originated in his disappearance. But he transferred it to Mahakashyapa, and now it was the responsibility of Mahakashyapa to go on finding people whom he can transfer. So since that moment 25 centuries before, it has been transferred without any arbitrary means, without any language, from master to disciple, from one who has come home to one who is just wandering around but cannot find the way. The master functions as a friend. He holds your hand and takes you on the right path, helps you to open your eyes, helps you to be capable of transcending the mind. That's where your third eye opens. You start looking inwards. And once you are looking inwards, the master's work is finished. Now it is up to you. You can travel that small gap between your mind and no mind in a single moment of tremendous intensity and urgency, or you can travel slowly, hesitantly, stopping, being afraid that you are losing grip of your mind, you are losing grip of your individuality, that all boundaries are disappearing. What are you doing? You may think for a moment, this may bring a breakdown. You may not be able to come back to the mind again. And who knows what is going to happen ahead. Things are disappearing. If you pay too much attention on the things that are disappearing, you may stop out of fear. The master goes on focusing your mind on things that are happening, not on things that are disappearing. He goes on forcing, look at the blissfulness. Look at the silence that is descending on you. Look at the peace. Look at the joy. Look at the ecstasy. He is continuously emphasizing to that which is happening, not to that which is going away, the anxiety, the despair, the angst, the anguish. He is not allowing you even to take note of them. What is disappearing is not worth keeping. Just go on looking what is appearing out of nothingness. So you gather courage. You become more daring. You know that nothing is going to be wrong. On every single inch movement, something greater is happening. And finally, as you enter to the very source of your being, the center of your being, the whole universe falls upon you. Just as Kabir said before he died, the whole ocean has fallen into the dewdrop. And once you have experienced this beatitude, this ecstasy, this divine drunkenness, who cares about individuality? Who cares about the self? What the self has given to you, except anxiety, except hell. And this nothingness is so pure, without boundaries, for the first time you find the infinity, the eternity, and all the mysteries of existence are suddenly opening their doors to you. And they go on opening door after door. There is no end to this journey. It is an endless pilgrimage. You are always arriving and arriving and arriving, but you never arrive. But each moment you are going deeper into bliss, deeper into ecstasy, deeper into truth. But there is no full stop. The Zen manifesto is in absolute need because all old religions are falling apart, and before they fall apart and humanity goes completely bananas, Zen has to be spread wide around the whole earth. Before the old house falls down, you have to create a new house. And this time, don't commit the same mistake. You have been living in a house which was not there. Hence you were suffering rain, winter, sun, because the house was only in imagination. This time, really enter into your original home. Not any man-made temple, not any man-made religion. Enter into your own existence. Why be continuously a carbon copy? This time is very valuable. You are born in a very fortunate moment when the old has lost its evidence, its proof. When the old is simply hanging around you because you are not courageous enough to get out of the prison, otherwise doors are open. There have been never any doors, because the house you are living in is completely imaginary. Your gods are imaginary, your priests are imaginary, your holy scriptures are imaginary. This time don't commit the same mistake. This time humanity has to take a quantum leap from the old rotten lies to the fresh, eternally fresh truth. This is the manifesto of Zen. The second question, D.T. Suzuki, the man who introduced Zen to the Western intelligentsia, has said, Zen must be seized with bare hands, with no gloves on. Would you like to comment? His statement is rationally beautiful. You should seize Zen with your bare naked hands, with no gloves on. He is meaning by that you should enter into the world of Zen without any beliefs, without any security, without any safety, without any gloves, with naked hands, with nakedity, nudity. You should enter into Zen. But his statement is still intellectual. He was not a man of Zen, neither a master of Zen. Because if he has been a master of Zen, he could not have said it. A master of Zen cannot say that Zen must be seized. It is not a question of seizing Zen. It is the old language of the mind of conquering nature. Now it becomes conquering Zen. Zen is your reality, whom you are going to seize, whom you are going to conquer. You are Zen. And what does he mean by with bare hands? Hands will not reach there. Bare or with gloves on. Hands symbolize the movement outwards. They always point towards the outward. All your senses open to the out. They are all extrovert. Your ears hear the sound that is coming from the outside. Your eyes see colors, light that are coming from the outside. Your hand goes on grabbing that is outside you. Neither of your senses can reach to the inside. For the inside there is a different sensitivity, the third eye. There are no hands. Just between your two eyebrows, exactly in the middle, is exactly the place which can look inwards. When you are with closed eyes trying to look inwards, rushing towards your center, you are hitting on the third eye continuously because it has not been open for centuries. It has forgotten to open. Hence, everyday meditation, and one day suddenly you will find the eye has opened. And the whole path is clean and clear. You have simply to walk to the center. No, there is no hands, and there is no question of conquering. It is your nature. The very idea that Zen must be seized creates a duality. You are the person who are going to seize Zen, and Zen is something else than you. It creates a duality. That's what gives me a clear-cut idea whether the man is just intellectual or has the experience. I have my clear-cut criterions how to know that a man is talking only from mind. However clever D.T. Suzuki may be, I say unto you, he is not a master. He is still living in duality. Mind is dual. It always divides things into two polar opposites, the conqueror and the conquered, the observer and the observed, the object and the subject, the day and the night. It goes on dividing everything which are not divided. Neither the day is divided with the night, nor the birth is divided with death. They are one energy. But mind goes on dividing into everything into two polarities, opposites. Nothing is opposite in existence. Every contradiction is only apparent. Deep down, all contradictions are meeting together. So when somebody says, seize, conquer, he is still talking in the language of the mind and is still being violent. His words show it. Zen has to be not the object, not the subject. It is a transcendental experience. Duality of all kinds is transcended. The observer and the observed become one. The knower and the known become one. So it is not a question of conquering or seizing. It is a question of relaxing into yourself. It is not a fight or a war. It is pure resting. Sinking in your rest deeply. And as you sink deeper and deeper, you find you are melting. The moment you come to oneness with existence, you have arrived to your nature. It can be possible only through relaxation, through rest. Suzuki's statement is rational but not existential, and Zen is the only existential approach in the whole world. A little biographical note. Once when he was traveling, Tanka Tenen stopped overnight in a temple. You know the meaning of Tenen. It means absolutely natural. Zen is your nature. Whether you know it or not does not make any difference. If you know, you will not stumble unnecessarily. You will not go on falling into the same ditches again and again. If you know, you will walk like a man with eyes. If you don't know, you will walk with eyes but closed. Your life will suffer unnecessary misery, tension, anxiety. But there is no difference as far as your inner nature is concerned. You are a Buddha all the time, sleeping, waking, whether you know it or not. If you know, life becomes a bliss. If you don't know, life becomes a misery. So it is simply you. If you are ready to sink deep within yourself, being in deep rest, it is not a victory. It is just remembering that Buddhahood is your nature, it is your Dhamma. Tanka Tenen stopped overnight in a temple. It was so cold that he made a fire of one of the wooden Buddha statues. When he was chastised the following morning by the temple monks, Tanka explained that he had burned the statue so he could take Buddha's bones. How could a wooden statue have bones? A monk asked Tanka Tenen. Then why have you chastised me? Replied Tanka. In the night, only a man of immense insight, only a man who knows his Buddhahood can burn a statue of Buddha. The night was so cold. The real Buddha was suffering from cold and the unreal Buddha was enthroned. So he took one of the statues. It was a wooden statue, so he burned it and was quite happy. In the morning when the monks of the temple found that he has burnt a statue of Buddha, obviously they were very angry that what kind of man you are. We thought you are a Zen master and you have destroyed one of our most valuable Buddha. What was the purpose? He said the night was very cold. He was simply showing to those monks that you have forgotten your Buddha nature and you are worshipping statues made by men. Buddhas are worshipping statues of wood or stone or marble. This is absurd. What kind of spiritual sleep you are suffering from? Have you completely forgotten who you are? So he said it was cold night and the Buddha was feeling the cold very much. And a false Buddha was just sitting there. I burnt the statue. It was just wood. To make it completely clear, he said, I was trying to find Buddha's bones in the world of the Buddha. The bones of a Buddha are called flowers. Where a Buddha has awakened, even bones are no more bones. So they are not referred as bones, they are referred as flowers. And slowly, slowly, it has become widespread in India that now everybody's bones, when somebody dies in India, the body has to be burned on a funeral pyre. And on the third day, when the fire has completely cooled down and the body is completely burned, third day, the relatives, the friends go to the burning place to collect the flowers. That is the expression. They are going to collect the bones . Those bones has to be dissolved either into a river or into the ocean for eternal rest. But they are not referred as bones. First time it was Gautam Buddha's bones which were referred as flowers. How can you say Gautam Buddha's bones, just bones? In that body lived the first awakened man. In that body radiated the splendor, the bliss arising from nowhere. It is because of this Buddha has said, this very body the Buddha and this very earth the lotus paradise. When you know your nothingness, it radiates even from your bones, your eyes, your skin. Everything takes a new grace, a new grandeur, a new majesty. Your words become golden. Your silence becomes so precious. A song without sounds. Even when the Buddha walks, his body is expressing his Buddhahood. If the Buddha looks into your eyes, his eyes are expressing the ultimate truth. Whether he says anything or not, he is continuously diffusing a certain energy all around him. He is a radiator. A radiation of the ultimate bliss. So naturally, if a man like Gautama Buddha became enlightened when he was 42 years old and lived for 40 years afterwards, 40 years continuously, the Buddha inside the bones and the flesh and the skin. How it is possible that all these bones and skin will not be affected by this tremendous metamorphosis? Hence came the expression, flowers. The man who has translated it has forgotten. He simply says that Tanka Tenen said, I had to burn the statue so I could take Gautama Buddha's flowers, not bones. Everything changes with your change of consciousness. Everything becomes tremendously beautiful. This was just to provoke those monks, so they are cornered. Immediately the high priest of the temples must have said, how could a wooden statue have bones? How could a wooden statue have flowers? Tanka has made his point. He is saying that a wooden statue is not a Buddha. It has not even the bones, it has not even the flowers of Buddha. It is simply wood cut in a certain shape. You have given the shape to the wood, but you cannot make it a Buddha. Once the monks were cornered, Tanka said, then why have you chastised me? Then why you are angry at me? There are many versions of this story. The version that I love, and I don't know whether it is in the scriptures or not. I don't know from where I got it. But I am absolutely certain that is the right version. It is not in the morning that Tanka Tenen was found. It was in the middle of the night when the priest saw a fire burning in the temple, and they were asleep in the temple. The archpriest came running, that are you mad or something? What are you doing? You have burnt one of my most valuable Buddhas. At that time Tanka took his staff and the Buddha was almost burned. So he started looking for flowers by his staff into the ashes
of the Buddha. The high priest said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I am looking for Buddha's flowers. I have heard that Buddha has bones, and those bones turn into flowers. I am looking for those flowers." The high priest laughed. He said, "You are certainly insane. It is just a wooden statue, it is not a Buddha." And Tanka Tenen says, "Aha! So it is not the Buddha." And the night is still long and very cold, and you have so many wooden statues, just bring one or two more. The high priest said, "You are a very dangerous fellow. I cannot allow you to stay in the temple." And he forced Tanka Tenen outside the temple in the middle of the night. It was cold winter, icy cold. And Tanka Tenen said, "What are you doing? You are my high priest and you are throwing me out just to keep your wooden statues safe. You are throwing the Buddha out." But the high priest did not listen. He just pushed him out and closed the doors. And in the morning when he opened the doors, Tanka Tenen was sitting by the side of the road by a milestone, and he has collected few wild flowers and he has put those wild flowers on the milestone, and he was sitting there reciting a beautiful mantra that the disciples of Buddha used to recite before him. Buddham Saranam Gacchami. I go to the feet of the Buddha. Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. I go to the feet of the ultimate truth. Sangham Saranam Gacchami. I go to the feet of those who are the commune of the awakened one. The priest said, "Listen, you burnt my Buddha. That was an insane act. Now you are doing even more mad behavior. This is a milestone, not a Buddha. And you have put flowers on it. And you are going to the feet of this milestone." Tanka Tenen said, "It is the same. Just an excuse. You have wooden statues as an excuse. I have this stone. Hidden in it there is a wooden, there is a stone Buddha. If some sculptor tries to take out all unnecessary pieces, a Buddha will appear. Any excuse will do. I burnt one of your excuses and you were so angry. This is just the same as your wooden statues. Neither this stone has Buddha's bones." And I am simply wanting in the early morning sun with this beautiful breeze and flowers fragrant all around, and the birds started chirping and making their joyful sounds. I have to show my gratitude to the man who is the source of my family. Without him, perhaps there would not have been so many enlightened people. Gautama Buddha started a new chapter in the consciousness of humanity. Obviously, I go to his feet and I go to the truth that he revealed, and I go to the feet of those who became enlightened because of his sharing the enlightenment. I would not have been the light that I am right now if Buddha has not transferred to Mahakashyapa that which cannot be said into a lotus flower. I am showing my gratitude to the first man in the history of mankind who has risen above mind. This I know is the right story. If you don't find it in the scriptures, correct. Wherever you find those scriptures, correct. Because this does not show exactly Tankattene's approach. It is very poor. And I love the riches. And the real richness comes from your awareness, your consciousness. This way Tankattene was trying to make all those priests and monks aware that what are you doing? You have forgotten the real thing and you are worshipping statues. Any stone will do. Because in every stone the Buddha is hidden. I remember one story about Michelangelo. He was passing by the market where marble was sold. And he saw before a shop a big rock of marble. And he asked the owner that how much it will cost. The owner said nothing because it has been there for 10 years and nobody even has asked about it. And I don't have space in my shop, so I have thrown it outside on the other side of the road. You can take it. It will give me space to put few other rocks. This rock seems to be absolutely absurd, of no use. So Michelangelo took that rock and after a year he invited the owner of the shop that now you can come and see. Your rock has blossomed. And it was Michelangelo's greatest work of art, which has been destroyed just few years before by a madman. It was a statue of Jesus Christ. His mother, Mary, has taken the body of Jesus Christ from the cross, and Jesus is lying almost naked in her lap, and she is looking at her face. It was one of the most beautiful statues in the world. The sharpener could not believe in his eyes. He said, "How did you manage?" He said, "It was not me. When I passed by the side of the rock, Jesus called me that I am lying down in this rock. Just remove the unnecessary parts and I will be revealed." And as I looked at the rock, I could see Jesus in the lap of his mother, by the side of the cross. It looked strange because of this statue was hidden behind it, the cross. Jesus lying in the lap of his mother and Maryam. So it looked very strange type of rock. But I have just done a little work of chipping unnecessary parts, and you can see the miracle has happened. That statue was in the Vatican, and just few years before, perhaps 10 years before, a madman with a hammer just went in and broke the head of Jesus, Maryam, and finished that beautiful statue that may not be made again, because Michelangelo's don't happen that often. He was caught, but it was too late. And in the court, that man said that, "I am not a Michelangelo, so I cannot create, but I can destroy. And I wanted my name to become history. And I wanted to see my picture on all the newspapers on the front page. And I have succeeded in it. And I am ready for any punishment." The judge was at a loss what to say this man. He has destroyed one of the most precious things, the most beautiful work of art, just to have his photograph in the newspapers on the front page and his name in the history, that Michelangelo created and this man destroyed. And he was ready. He said, "I am ready even to go to the gallows. It doesn't matter." If you have eyes like Michelangelo, then every stone becomes something that ordinary people cannot see. Only a Michelangelo can penetrate, just like X-rays, deep into the stone. And it can become a Jesus, it can become a Buddha. Tanka Tenen was saying, "What is the need of all those statues when the real Buddha was feeling the immense cold of the night and you pushed me out?" And this has been, Tanka said, the story of all the religions. They push the Buddha out and they worship Buddha's statues. The sutra. When Tenjiku was asked about the incident of Tanka Tenen burning the statue, he replied, "When it is cold, we gather around the hearth by the fire."
Tenjiku is another master. When he was asked about the burning of the statue of Buddha by Tenin, he replied, "There is nothing wrong." He didn't say anything, he simply said, "When it is cold, we gather around the hearth by the fire." Was he wrong or not? Persisted the monk. "When it is hot, we sit in a bamboo forest in the valley," said Tenjiku. He is not saying right or wrong, that is the way of Zen, not to decide right or wrong. He is simply saying every Zen master behaves spontaneously. When it is hot, he goes under the shadows of a bamboo forest. When it is cold, he burns wood. He is not mentioning at all whether Tanka Tenen has done anything wrong. He is simply saying everybody who is aware functions spontaneously. Finding no other wood, Tanka Tenen found the wooden statue of Buddha. There is nothing wrong in it. When it is cold, one needs fire. And when it is hot, one needs sago. And Zen is absolutely natural. You should function according to your nature, and your spontaneity should come your response. The day after the burning of the statue, Tanka Tenen went to see Nanyo, who had once been a disciple of Inno and was the emperor's Zen master. When Tanka unrolled his Zazen rug, Nanyo said, "There is no need." That reminds me, perhaps the little Siddhartha is still here, or maybe he is gone. When he had come many, many years before, he was a small child, very small, maybe 3 years old or 4 years old. I can see exactly the moment he came to me. He has brought a small rug and he came as if a grown-up, perhaps Manisha will remember, she was present, and he unrolled the rug like the Zen disciples do. And he touched my feet. All those who were present started laughing. This little boy was doing a real thing which is not expected from such a little boy. He touched my feet with great gratefulness, with grace, and then sat down on his rug. That's why I gave him the name Siddharth. Siddharth is Gautam Buddha's name given by his father. It is as beautiful as Buddha. It means one who has arrived. Siddharth, one who has found the meaning, one who has found the significance of existence. Just now he has been here for almost 1 month, I don't know whether he is here or not. Now he has come with a girlfriend, has become very grown up. I was reported by Anando that when he entered the gate after so many years, he had tears in his eyes. He must have remembered the first day he had come to me, almost 20 years before. And he was such a lovely child that his mother reported to me that it is very difficult to find where he is, because he goes with everybody. He has such a great friendship with all the sannyasins, and he was a little child. He used to ask anybody, just give me 10 rupee notes. I am going to see the movie. And it was not only one-sided. If somebody was in need of money, he will bring the money from others and give to the person that keep it. But remember, whenever I need, whenever you can pay. So people used to ask Siddhartha that, can you manage 20 rupees? He will immediately go. He had the whole commune, his friendship, and nobody could refuse him. He was so lovely, so innocent, that those tears he must have remembered the first day he had come. Still he is innocent, and he is growing well on his own. His father has died. He is in a very good art school, learning acting. I was happy to know when he informed me that he is learning acting, because actors can be very easily meditators, because they are always acting somebody else wrong, so they can witness also that it is not their identity. They may become Jesus Christ in a film, but they know they are not Jesus Christ. So, to recognize that their performance is not their being is very easy. To me, acting is one of the best professions for meditators, because it will teach you your identity can change every day. An actor is filming, moving from one film to another. In one film he is one thing, in another film he is something else, in third film he is somebody else. So slowly, slowly he can become aware, if he knows the art of becoming aware, that all these identities come and go. And finally he can recognize that his own personality is nothing but an acting, taught by his parents and the priests and the politicians and the professors. All these people are creating a certain personality around you, which is not your real being. It is just for convenience sake. They are creating a social being out of an spiritual being. A social being is an ordinary thing. Your spiritual being is vast and immense. This
The day after the burning of the statue, Tanka Tenen went to see Nanyo, who had once been a disciple of Ino and was the emperor's Zen master. Certainly he was a very important man, emperor's Zen master. When Tanka unrolled his Zazen rug, Nanyo said, "There is no need, because that rug is spread by only disciples, and you are already a master, you don't have to do it." And Tanka Tenen was doing it just out of respect, because this man, Nanyo, was very old, emperor's master. And Tanka Tenen was a young man, although he has become enlightened. This is the Eastern way of always being respectful to the elders. Because it used to be a part of natural growth. If a man lives naturally, then just as he becomes sexually mature at the age 14, he will become capable of going out of sexual biological bondage by the age 42. If he lives very naturally, and by the time he gets out of the biological control, it is very easy for him to get out of the mind. The ancient calculation is by the age 49, one can meditate so easily without any effort. The only condition is if he has lived without repressive religions, gods and priests, if he has lived just like a simple, natural human being, without any inhibition, without any guilt, then 42 he gets out of the biological control. Your sex is your bondage. It is a biological bondage. Don't fight against it. If you fight against it, you will not be out even at the age 80 or 90. You will not be out of it at any point. Even when you are dying, your last thought will be about sex. It has been counted that every man thinks at least once about sex within 3 minutes. And every woman thinks about sex every 7 minutes one time. That is a disparity. That is why men look more sex-oriented than women. The difference is not much. 3 minutes or 7 minutes is not much of a thing. The man has to wait only for 4 minutes. In that 4 minutes, the woman can have the headache and take 2 aspirins. And she will be ready. It is the responsibility of your religions to keep you in the bondage of sex by teaching you celibacy. Celibacy is a perversion of your nature. I want you to be absolutely natural. When it is time for sex, it is time for sex. You will be out by the age 42. Just simply out. No question of making any effort to be celibate. Whenever you make any effort, it is against nature. Nature does not allow any effort. It wants you to be utterly relaxed with it. And then nature goes on doing things to you. By the time you are 49, you are really mature. And you have passed 7 years without the bondage of sex. One of the best novelists of this century, Kazantzakis, who wrote Zorba the Greek, he also wrote a book about Jesus, The Last Temptation. Jesus was only 33. And I agree with Kazantzakis that on the cross came the last temptation. In the hot summer day, he is hanging on the cross. And do you think he will think about God? He started having a dream about Mary Magdalene. A dream that perhaps if I had lived differently and I had loved Mary Magdalene and I would not have got into this trip. I would not be hanged on this cross. In The Last Temptation, Kazantzakis depicts this whole dream. Because of this dream, he was expelled from the Greek Orthodox Church. His book was banned all around the world because everywhere Christians were protesting against it, that this is too much. When the film was made in a movie, everywhere there were great demonstrations against the movie. And Kazantzakis, one of the best novelists of this century, lived in utter misery and trouble because the church has condemned him, expelled him. Just now, he is dead. My sannyasin Amrito in Greece knows his wife. And she has been to see her and asked her that would she like to become part of this sannyas movement. She said, I would love, but I am afraid. I have suffered so much because of my husband's suffering, the utter condemnation everywhere. And he has not done anything wrong. I absolutely support him. It's absolutely natural. His insight is clear that a man of 33, hanged on the cross, is bound to think that, my God, what I have done. If I had lived a different life with a beautiful woman who always wanted to live with me, and I was trying to tell her, get away, you are a temptation, get away. At the last moment, the temptation must have come to him. I can say with absolute authority that Kazantzakis is right. It is absolutely natural to remember Mary Magdalene, one of the most beautiful women whom he has been denying. That was unnatural. And when God has failed to do any miracle, he certainly would have thought that it would have been right for me to have a wife, children, and live naturally. I unnecessarily went on to this number of being the only begotten Son of God, and there seems to be no God at all. And 6 hours are enough on the cross to bring anybody to his senses. Now there is a movement amongst the intelligentsia of Europe that posthumously he should be accepted by the church again, but church is absolutely adamant. That man cannot be accepted back as a Christian. He has done immense harm to the image of Jesus Christ. He has done immense good to the image of Jesus Christ. He is saying that Jesus Christ is not a pervert. He is a natural human being. He has given as much respect to Jesus Christ as no one else because of this dream. His wife said, I am simply afraid. Your master is continuously in trouble, is going to be in trouble. And I have suffered too much and I am too old. I would have loved, but my whole life I suffered because first my husband wrote Zorba the Greek and the church was angry. And then he wrote The Last Temptation and the whole world was protesting, burning his film, burning his books. Religions have done such harm that it is almost unbelievable. And they are still doing. In the East, particularly, when religions have not become organized, when religion was a freedom, individual affair, people were very natural. And they came to celibacy naturally. And when celibacy comes naturally, it has a totally different flavor. There is no suppression, there are no sexual dreams, there is no question. And by the time you are going to the age 50, in India, the age 50 is called getting ready for the forest. Vanaprastha. By the time you are 50, your children will be coming back from their schools, colleges, universities. Now they will take care
of your business, you can look now towards the forest. Perhaps you have to wait for a few days to teach your children the practical aspects of life. They have been in the universities, in the forest universities, and they don't know anything about practical life. They have been meditating, they have been learning, they have been with great seers, and they are coming utterly innocent about the practical aspects of the world. So perhaps for 25 years, that was the Indian calculation, 25 years for education, 25 years for living as a household man or woman, 25 years preparing to go to the Himalayas or to go to the forests. 25 years, last 25 years, absolutely devoted to meditation. If life is 100 years, then this was the division. Four parts, absolutely natural. By the time one is 75, he should retire into the forest. Now it is time to prepare for death, for another journey, for another experience. Life has passed away. Because of this, the older the man, the more respect was shown to him. And he was worthy of it. If he has lived naturally, he was worthy of it. So when Tankatenin unrolled his zazen rug, Nanyo said, "There is no need." He was an old man. He could recognize Tankatenin immediately. Only the enlightened person can recognize another enlightened being. There is no other way. The unenlightened cannot recognize the enlightened. The enlightened can recognize both, the unenlightened and the enlightened. The higher can recognize the lower, but the lower cannot recognize the higher. Because the higher has both the experience of the lower and of the higher. The lower has only the experience of the lower. He does not know anything beyond it. But it is the difficulty with the lower. The masses who have never known anything of the higher, they decide things. They decide who is enlightened, who is not enlightened. It is so hilarious. One newspaper from Indore has written an editorial and asked his readers to vote whether I am enlightened or not. So I have informed Chaitanya Kirti to write to him that how many of your readers are enlightened. And first you should think about yourself. Are you enlightened? Can you recognize an enlightened person without being enlightened? But this kind of stupidity goes on and on. The people who had the experience were naturally respected by the younger generation. Because they have known many, many divisions of life. They have been in all the stages. And they have passed beyond. Now they have become again innocent like a child. They are getting ready to enter again into existence. But Nanyo immediately said, there is no need. You are as enlightened as I am. You are as a master as I am. Here, age does not matter. Here, time is of no account. Tanka took a few steps backward. These are the ways of Zen. Unless you understand their symbology, their whole metaphoric language, you will miss the whole point. Tanka took a few steps backward. What does it show? He is saying that I have gone deep into myself. You are right. Taking few steps backward means going inward. Nanyo said, that's right. You have gone really deep. At this, Tanka took a few steps forward, just to check on the master what he says. Nanyo said, that's not right. Taking few steps forward is going outwards. Taking few steps backward is going inward. Backward and inward are equivalent. Forward and outward are equivalent. Nanyo said, that's not right. At this, Tanka took a few steps. And went, walk around Nanyo one time and left. He has paid the tribute that I had come to see whether you are really that great as everyone talks about you. I have found you are simply the right man to be the master of the emperor himself. On each point, Nanyo proved right. When he was trying to unroll his rug, he stopped him. There is no need. Then he took few steps backward. He immediately said, that is right. At this, Tanka took a few steps forward. Nanyo said, that is not right. Tanka walked around Nanyo. Walking around Nanyo is a symbol of great respect. Making the circle complete from the source, coming back again to the source as a goal. By making this circle complete, he expressed that you are entirely enlightened, completely enlightened. I have nothing to ask, nothing to say. He simply left. Just no word, no question. Those symbols were enough. Nanyo commented, when Tanka left, the old golden days are far away. It used to be very common, enlightenment. It used to be very common to find such a man as Tanka Tanin. But those golden days are far away. And people are now so lazy that they will not even take few steps backward, inward. 30 years from now, he made a prophecy, it will be difficult to get hold of this fellow.
He was too young and he has already expressed his immense clarity and his enlightenment. After 30 years, when he becomes a ripened being and his circle is complete, it has begun to move towards completion. He said, 30 years from now, this man will be one of the greatest masters ever known. It will be very difficult to get hold of this fellow. It is in deep respect and love that old Nanyo recognized not only his enlightenment, but also recognized that it is not far away, only 30 years, and he will be a perfect Buddha. Then it will be very difficult to get hold of this fellow. Hayakusai wrote, "First frost, my way lies northeast, facing the stars." That is the way for everyone who is going deeper into meditation. It seems you are going deeper into meditation, but simultaneously something in you is going higher towards the stars. It is happening simultaneously. The roots go deeper and the tree goes higher. In your meditation, you are creating roots deep into your sources. When the nourishment is available, your consciousness will start moving towards the stars, a pillar of light going towards the beyond. First frost, my way lies northeast, facing the stars. A man of meditation, wherever he goes, he is always moving towards the stars, because he is always moving towards the very source of nourishment. Once he gets his roots fixed into the earth, then there is no problem. Wherever he is moving higher and higher, like a cedar of Lebanon. Those ancient trees, hundreds, thousands year old, are standing, still growing towards the stars. The beauty of those trees simply reminds the same is the way for human consciousness. Deeper into the earth, higher into the sky. Manisa's question. D.T. Suzuki describes two different kinds of seeing as denoted by two different Chinese characters. I have just told you, D.T. Suzuki is still in the mind, hence the division. Even seeing becomes of two kinds. D.T. Suzuki describes two different kinds of seeing as denoted by two different Chinese characters. Kan consists of a hand and an eye and means to watch an object as independent of the spectator. Objective knowledge. You are watching a tree. The tree is different from you. This is one kind of seeing. The seen and the seeing are two separate entities. On the other hand, the character qian is composed of an eye alone and two outstretched legs and signifies the pure act of seeing. Suzuki's Suzuki considers the difference between these two kinds of seeing as revolutionary in the history of Zen thought. In the first place, Zen is not a thought. In the second place, the act of pure seeing cannot be called at all an act of pure seeing. What you are seeing. For seeing to be seeing, you need an object. The meditator goes beyond the object and beyond the subject. Beyond the first Chinese character kan, which signifies duality. The seer and the seen, the knower and the known. And the second character qian, which signifies the pure act of seeing. But the very word seeing means something is there. Otherwise, how you can see? What you can see? If there is nothing, seeing disappears. Being appears. Hence, I will not agree with D.T. Suzuki at all. These two kinds of seeing are just mind, logic, rationality, but not meditation, not Zen. Zen is going beyond the seen and beyond the seen. It is going into being. Just being, utterly silent, at ease with existence. There is no duality, and there is not oneness either. You have to understand it. Because if there is no duality, you cannot call it oneness. One suggests immediately about the two. Hence, Gautama Buddha does not use the word oneness. He uses the word not two-ness, advaita. It makes great difference. When you say one, immediately you are reminded of two. How one can exist without two and three and four and five and six and seven? One is a digit. It is just below two. If one exists, then thousand numbers will follow, or millions, or trillions. There is no end to it. If you have stepped on one, you are on a long journey without end. To avoid this, a roundabout way has been found, not to say oneness with existence, but to say not two-ness. It exactly means oneness, but to say that in language creates the difficulty. Without two, how can there be one? So don't say one, just say not two. The one is understood. It has not to be said. It is the inexpressible. But by saying not two, you have indicated towards it. Simple gesture. Without making any noise about it, you have hinted it. It is a pure hint. Suzuki misses the point. The revolutionary step is not Zen thought, but Zen
experience. And that experience is of not-two-ness. There is no seer and no seen, but just being. It is time for Sardar Gurjaz. Put the lights on. I love to see my people laughing. I am absolutely against seriousness. But unfortunately, I have to discuss serious things. But it is good to make you first serious, then laughter comes more easily. Then it gives a great relaxation. Little Albert comes running into the village store and races up to the counter. "Hey, mister," he cries to old Joke, the owner, "my dad was fixing the roof when the ladder slipped from under him. Now he is hanging by his fingers from an upstairs window ledge." "Well, son," says old Joke, "you have come to the wrong place. You want the police station across the road? And hurry." "No," says Albert, "you don't understand. I want some more film for my camera." One Sunday morning, at the Looney Tunes funny farm, old Father Fungus is the guest preacher in the lunatic asylum's small chapel. He is ranting and raving in the pulpit, screaming all about damnation and hellfire, God's sweet love and the nocturnal emissions of the Holy Ghost. Suddenly, Mad Melvin jumps up out of his seat, raises both arms high in the air and shouts, "Bullshit! Do we have to listen to this idiot?" Then Mad Melvin smiles and sits back down. There is pin drop silence. Father Fungus is extremely embarrassed and turns to the hospital doctor. "Doctor, dumb shit." "Ah, dear," stammers the priest. "Shall I stop speaking?" "No need for that, Father," sighs dumb shit, yawning. "It won't happen again. Mad Melvin only makes a true statement once every 7 years. Two famous music lovers, Cardinal Cat's Ass and Pope the Pollock, are sipping wine and having an intimate chat in the Pope's private Vatican chambers. "Did you know," says Cat says, confiding in the old papal fruitcake, "that I have a very special musical friend?" "Really?" says the Pope. "Yes," continues Cat says, "I treat her just like a guitar. I finger the top and play the bottom and get beautiful music." "Well," says Pope the Pollock, "I must confess that I have a very special musical friend too." "Really?" exclaims Cat says. "Yes," continues the Pollock Pope, "I treat mine more like a pop record. I place her on the deck and we make beautiful music. And then 3 minutes later, I turn her over." silent. Close your eyes and feel your body to be completely frozen. This is the right moment to look inwards. Gather your energies and your total consciousness. And rush towards your very center of being. It is just below the navel, exactly 2 inches below, inside you. But only those will succeed who rush with an urgency and intensity as if this is the last moment of your life. You have to make it now or never, faster and faster. Deeper and deeper. You are coming closer to the center of your being. A great silence is descending over you like soft rain. You can feel the coolness. With you, the whole night has become silent. A little more closer to your center, and a great peace surrounds you, engulfs you. You are drowned in it. It is the peace that mystics have called peace that passeth understanding. A little more closer and blossoms, flowers start showering over you of bliss. Of ecstasy, you are starting to feel like a drunk, but this is not an ordinary drunkenness. It is divine drunkenness, and only in this divine drunkenness you can take the last step. Enter into your center. This is the opening into the beyond. This is the place where you are joined with the cosmos. You will meet here your original face. The face of Gautama the Buddha has been accepted in the East as a symbol of everybody's original face. Meeting the Buddha is a very strange experience because you start disappearing. Fading away. And as you fade away, Buddha becomes more and more solid and strong. It is your very essential being. The only quality the Buddha has is witnessing. You have to get more and more attuned with this quality, because only this quality can bring your Buddha from the center to the circumference. He can become your whole life. He is the ultimate dance. Gautam the Buddha is the Zen manifesto. Witnessing, you start disappearing. That's what I have called freedom from the self. Witness that you are not the body. Witness that you are not the mind. Witness that you are only a witness. And everything starts settling. To make this witnessing more clear and deeper, Nivedana, relax. It is only a question of relaxing. It is not an effort. It is just falling deep into your own depth, resting at the very center of your life source. This life source, this juice that is flowing all around you, will start a tremendous metamorphosis within you. You will feel you are melting, melting, melting. Gautam the Buddha auditorium is becoming an ocean of consciousness. 10,000 Buddhas have disappeared into one oceanic experience. This is the Zen manifesto. Freedom from oneself. Gather all these experiences, the grace, the beauty, the truth, the blissfulness. You have to bring them with you. They have to become your day-to-day life. I don't teach another morality. I teach this spontaneity, and the morality follows like a shadow. And because it comes from your very sources, you never feel being commanded, you never feel being dominated, you never feel being a slave. You never feel being a sheep. You start being a lion. Your morality, your response to existence becomes a lion's roar. The beauty and the power that is harmless. The love that simply overflows you. Unconditional. Just a gift. A blessing to the whole existence. and a grace that changes not only your consciousness but even your body. Your gestures become so meaningful, so significant, so beautiful, like roses. Your eyes become like stars. Your heart starts beating in tune with the universal heart. This synchronicity is the Zen manifesto. And don't forget to persuade Gautam Buddha to come with you. These are the three steps of enlightenment. The first, Gautam Buddha comes behind you just as a shadow. But the shadow is not dark. It is luminous. There is no person in it, but only presence, a tremendous presence. It is warm. You feel for the first time loved by existence itself. It is calm and cool at the same time. That's the miracle of Zen. On the second step, you become the shadow. And your shadow is certainly dark. It is false. It has been your prison. Gautam Buddha comes in front. It is a great revolution because your shadow immediately starts disappearing. And the third step comes spontaneously in. You are no more. Freedom from oneself. Only existence is, life is. Awareness is. All these are represented by the presence of Gautama the Buddha. He was the first man to bring this breakthrough in the history of man, to turn the horizontal consciousness into a vertical consciousness. Your roots go deep into the earth and your branches and your flowers blossom into the sky. This is meeting with the universe, merging into existence, and a great celebration arises not only in you, the whole existence participates in it. Nivedana, come back. But come back as Gautam the Buddha, with the same grace, the same beauty, same silence, the same divine drunkenness, and sit for a few moments to remind yourself the golden path you have traveled. the beautiful, the blissful, the ecstatic experience of reaching to the center of your being, which opens into cosmos. Zen is nothing but an opening into the cosmos. You disappear. Only existence remains. This is the ultimate freedom, freedom from oneself. This freedom becomes a great celebration. You dance with the stars, you dance with the ocean, you dance with the trees, you dance under the sky, under the stars. Suddenly, the whole cosmos has become your home. You are not a foreigner. You are not a stranger. You are not an outsider. You belong to this existence. This existence belongs to you. This is the revolution that Zen brings to humanity. This is Zen's great contribution to the world. It is right time that you should start celebrating life, dancing in deep synchronicity with existence, and spread this fire of Zen around the world. This is the only possibility to save humanity from committing suicide. Thank you.